problem is all inside your head, she said to me. The answer is easy if you take it logically. I'd like to help you in your struggle to be free. There must be 50 ways to leave your lover. She said it's really not my habit to intrude. Furthermore, I hope my meaning won't be lost or misconstrued. But I'll repeat myself at the risk of being crude. There must be 50 ways to leave your lover. 50 ways to leave your lover. You just slip out the back, Jack. Make a new plan, Stan. You don't need to be coy, Roy. Just get yourself free. Or hop on the bus, Gus. You don't need to discuss much. Just drop off the key, Lee, and get yourself free. Ooh, slip out the back, Jack. Make a new plan, Stan.
We'll just pull down right there. Hey, this is Swan.
And this is Nasa.
And you're listening to Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. Thanks for joining us. And today we have someone you might recognize, Ruth Barbie. Barbie. Damn it. Every time.
So Bear.
The first. Yeah, Barbie.
Rawr.
Yeah. And not the doll, but the animal.
Yeah, not Barbie. No. Barbie. Anyways, yeah, she came on and told us a story about Meryl's special blend, and it was wonderful. And she is a writer, many years writing, and her most recent project was the Babysitter's Fashion Club, which was mentioned in Slate, Bullet Media, and Billfold, and I'll include a link in the notes. You can check that out. Some nostalgic 90s stuff for you to gobble up because it's wonderful. Hi, welcome.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be back.
Yay. Yeah. And I was talking to you and you mentioned you had a project you were working on. You wanted to finish it and read it on the show. And so I think we can just hop right into that since it's a little bit longer. How are you feeling about it?
I'm okay. I'm going to get it over with.
Perfect. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, this is called The Monument. When we pull the car into the parking lot of the visitor center, Karen's already standing outside waiting to meet us. She's a small woman in her 40s, with small glasses and a small ponytail. Her handshake is small. Hank doesn't offer his. He often spaces out on little social graces like these. "We spoke on the phone," she says, and turns on her heel with a nod of her head to come along. We follow her through the double glass doors into the visitor center, which is bright and air-conditioned with a large teal-colored front desk in the shape of a comma and vaguely Native American-themed artwork on the walls. There's a water cooler and a plastic display of brochures bearing the image of the monument on their glossy fronts. We don't indulge in small talk. She shows us the cash box, how to run credit cards, and how to operate the phone if there are two calls coming in at the same time. But there won't be, she assures us. We fill out paperwork. She takes our photos. She gives us packets of tour material and says there's room for improvisation, but for the sake of clarity, she usually just sticks to the script. She guides us back outside and over the sun-bleached parking lot to go see the monument. This will go a lot smoother with two people, she says. We're following her along a snake-thin path that curls around a steep hill. One of you can be at the desk, and then the other can do the tours, or just hang out, whatever. Karen speaks with the slow carefulness of someone who's been spending a lot of time alone lately. How long did you say you've been out here? I try to sound interested, not accusing. A little over a year, Karen says over her shoulder. I had to stay relatively close to where I was living before while my divorce was finalized. But now that it is, I'll travel for 3 months and then maybe come back. We'll just have to see how it goes. Karen's calf muscles could cut a frozen steak in half. She walks sure-footedly with confident shoulders. She clearly memorized this trail a long time ago. Another sharp turn and a short hike down a wider path later, and we're at the monument. But to call it a monument is a bit of an overstatement. What it is 10 stones, roughly 3 by 3 feet each, arranged in a large oval, 36 feet in length. I'm surprised by how unremarkable they are up close. I was expecting shimmering, quartz-like rocks with strong, jutting angles, but these are just smooth, normal rocks you might find by any smooth, normal river. You might sit on one while you quietly fish. The oval formation covers the larger part of a grassy clearing. The grass is long and pale. There is shade from a rocky hill that juts out over one side of the clearing that, at this time of day, darkens one half of the oval. Karen suggests that we try out a practice tour, us as the tourists and her as the guide, to get a feel for how it will go. Hank pushes his glasses up and fires off questions for her to answer. How long has the monument been here? Who made it and why? Karen's answers are less than specific. Experts say the stones have been in this formation since sometime in the mid-18th century. The source of the stones is unknown. However, the area at the time was populated by the Adena, Hopewell, and Mississippian tribes, as well as a number of French and American fur trappers. She paces back and forth in front of the bottom curve of the monument. She starts talking about the Revolutionary War and when the area was colonized and what kind of rock the stones are, and I start zoning out. The air is warm and smells wonderful. The land here is shockingly lush, like it was handmade by an art department for a children's TV show about forest animals who are friends. Karen asks if we have any more questions, and it occurs to me, what do you think the monument is? Maybe some sort of religious site? Karen tilts her head and recites a line verbatim from the information packet. The stones are not typical of the native earthworks of that time. Then her face gets cloudy. But personally, I don't really give a shit. Behind the visitor center is the little house it was built onto. She takes us through a cedarwood door against the back wall and into the house's living room. It's large and open, but mostly windowless, giving it a sort of bunker quality. There are books on the shelf, a TV, a braided rug, and the room smells lightly of mothballs and chalk. There's a small kitchen to the left with a fridge that looks about a million years old. I wander around the room while Karen draws a map of how to get to town 20 minutes away. There's a stack of DVDs on top of the TV. Looking closer, I notice that they're all seasons of The Carol Burnett Show and Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In. Karen sees me eyeing them and tells me that they were here when she moved in and that there are lots of weird little odds and ends that different employees have left over the years. Hank asks her if she'd watched Laugh-In staying here. He hates stuff like that, anything with camp, anything openly soliciting a laugh. Karen nods and says, I have. Is it any good? I ask her. Karen smiles for the first time I've seen today, and hard. It is. After she leaves, we explore the house and find all the miscellaneous left behinds Karen mentioned. There's a collection of crumbling eyeshadow compacts in the medicine cabinet, a chin-up bar fastened in the bathroom doorway, a freezer bag full of matchbooks, many of them bearing the cowboy hat logo of a place called the Rodeo Diner. We poke around the kitchen, which is bare, so we drive to town using the map she made us. There's a grocery store on Main Street with a big fruits and vegetables stand outside. We get some groceries, toilet paper, and toothpaste. We buy a bunch of fruit. We drive around the town slowly looking at everything, the police station, an elementary school. We pass a restaurant with a neon sign bearing the same cowboy hat emblem from the matchbooks. It's a small town, so it doesn't take too much time to see. We drive back just as it's starting to get dark. After dinner, Hank sits back in his chair and says, Listen. I put my fork down. Nature is loud, he whispers. The crickets and frogs are on full blast, pulsing through the windows like our Sounds of Nature noise machine back in the city, but through a megaphone. I recall how we described this summer job to our friends. We called it a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity and a cool adventure, but more importantly, an easy way to earn money and not pay rent for a summer to save for the wedding. Hank opens a beer and looks out the window, tapping on the sink, adding percussion to this new symphony. He will stand quietly, tapping and tapping, for as long as I don't interrupt him. The next day is Sunday, the one day the monument is closed for business. We make coffee and practice our tour material, reading it to each other like uppity flight attendants. We unpack. Before I take a shower, I take my engagement ring off and leave it on the bathroom counter, and when I come out, Hank is leaning against the sink, holding the ring in his open palm, which he extends to me, still dripping from the shower. You should never take this off here. We're in the woods. If you lose it out here, it's gone forever. We go to the diner we saw yesterday with the cowboy hat on the sign. We have just missed the breakfast rush and sit in a cushioned booth. Our waitress is a woman about our age named Melissa, with pale but expressive eyebrows and a rosy milkmaid face. She instantly recognizes us as not from here and she suggests the Denver omelets, which are huge, and it takes us so long to eat them that her break comes along, and I invite her to have coffee with us. Hank shakes his head while her back is turned. It's not so much that he doesn't want the company, it's more that he assumes she wouldn't want to spend her time with us and is just being polite. He's more ambivalent than introverted. He just kind of expects that everyone is at his exact level of withdrawn, or more, if it was fully up to them. But Melissa seems to really like talking to us. She tells us about her daughter, who's 7, and wants to be a Kardashian when she grows up, and how that's a big issue with her husband, Kenneth, who's a fireman. She tells us about her sister, who manages the rec center, and how she's a huge bitch. They love each other, she reassures us. Blood is blood, but she's a huge bitch. She's fascinated that we're working at the monument. Everyone in town has been there. We used to go for field trips every year in school, but it was more like to have a big picnic and play outside. The land there is so damn beautiful. Hank isn't really saying much, just nodding and saying things like yes and yup. She's sitting on his side of the booth, and it makes him uncomfortable to turn fully to look at her. The first week of tours goes fine. I do most of them, with Hank trying to work up his nerve. Every morning when I wake up, I can hear him mumbling at himself in the bathroom mirror about earthworks, deciduous trees, the Hopewell tribe. The tour groups are small, usually just a couple of families stopping by on their way to the water park a few towns over, or church youth groups or campers from a nearby science camp. I pretty much stick to the script, as Karen suggested. People don't ask a lot of questions. On Wednesday night, over pancakes at the diner, Hank suddenly says, "I'm going to do all the tours next week. No exceptions." Great. If I want a life in academia, I have to get used to this, talking in front of people, making them listen. I'll bite the bullet. I believe in you, dude. I'm going to batten down the hatches. That's the spirit. Melissa comes by and refills our coffee. The diner is almost empty, so she lingers around to chat. She asks us if we like musicals, and Hank makes his mouth into a straight line. He does not like musicals, and for all the reasons you would expect from him. But I do, and tell her, of course, who doesn't like musicals, while I footsie Hank's shoe under the table. My daughter's in the end of the year play at her school. They're doing Annie, and I'm supposed to ask around, selling tickets. I know it's just a kid thing, but it might be fun if you like that kind of thing. I buy 2 tickets. They're only $8 each. And I know full well that Hank probably won't go. He has a migraine, I'll be likely to say, as I often do when he pulls out at the last minute. But he doesn't stay home. Friday night comes along, and after having a long, forlorn look out the kitchen window, he decides he might as well. There's nothing else to do at the house but watch TV or read or reorganize the furniture again. After the play, which is adorably bad, Melissa and I sip paper cups of room-temperature white wine, and Melissa's husband, Kenneth, talks to Hank about the fire station. Something about renovations to the main garage. I can't really make it out. Mostly he's just standing, square-footed, slightly looking over Hank's shoulder every so often, maybe keeping an eye out for fires. Melissa looks very different out of her waitress uniform, and in her jeans and scoop-necked shirt, she looks strikingly adult. Her eyebrows are filled in, and she has great posture and thick, elegant arms. Her daughter, Jenny, runs up to her with penciled-on freckles and lets out a gap-toothed scream. Melissa shushes her. I'm awkward around kids, but I want to have them one day, so I do my best to make conversation. You are very good in the play. How long have you been practicing for? This is a stretch. She was an anonymous orphan and barely did anything on stage outside of flapping her arms during It's a Hard Knock Life. Forever, she yells. All year. 2 months, Melissa says, with a tender roll of her eyes. That's very hard work and very long. I cringe at myself. How am I ever going to have kids? In the car ride home, Hank is quiet for a long time. We hung out with people. That's good. We can't spend the whole summer cooped up in that house. Hank shakes his head, annoyed, but then says, I know. Not everyone is like you. We spend the rest of the car ride in silence until Hank taps on the steering wheel, tapping until we pull into the parking lot. That week, Hank keeps his promise and does all the tours while I stay at the front desk. It's deathly boring, but I know Hank needs this. I look at the internet. I Google, what to do with too much fruit, because we went overboard at the fruit market the other day. I print out recipes for pies. I Google how to get your husband to be nicer to others, comma, outgoing. But the results are geared more towards women whose husbands are mean to them. Then I try how to get your husband to come out of his shell. But those results are mainly sex tips for unadventurous couples. I reorganize the office supplies drawer. I bite my thumbnail down to the cartilage. When we first lived together in the city, before we were engaged, we had a tiny apartment on the third floor of a building that was right across the street from an old greenhouse, now used as an event space, particularly for weddings. During wedding season, we would make coffee and sit by the window and play this game we invented called, "Who's going to be late for this wedding?" After seeing the crowd gather outside and go into the building around, say, 10:40 for an 11 o'clock wedding, we would watch gleefully as cars and cabs screeched to the curb at 11 on the dot, and then 5 after, and then 10 after, to watch the latecomers. The women wobbling over the sidewalk in their high heels, adjusting a bobby pin in their updos with their purses tucked into their armpit. Men straightening their ties and throwing wads of bills at their cab drivers. As we watched these panicked bodies staggering towards the entrance of the greenhouse, we did voiceovers for them. "Oh, no, 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 no," I pled shrilly for the woman, running knock-kneed in a tight pencil skirt. Hank spoke in his own regular voice, but I liked his captions, even if they were corny, barely jokes. "I'm supposed to be the best man," he said once for an oafish-looking tall man with shower-wet hair. "But really, I'm the worst man for being so late to this wedding." By the end of the week, Hank seems to have fallen into a good place when it comes to speaking in front of the crowds. On Friday night, he breezes into the house as the sun is setting, having just finished the last tour. I had heard him chatting with the youth group leaders in the parking lot through the kitchen window. His voice had an upswing to it, an engaging lilt that was unfamiliar and nice. Sitting at the kitchen table with his beer, his relaxed shoulders, and a glow on his face from being out in the sun all week, I feel a sudden kick of attraction to him. It kicks me square in the crotch. We have sex, starting in the kitchen and then moving to the bedroom because the kitchen floor is gross. My brain flashes back to the accidental Google search result I'd found earlier that week, 7 sex positions that will help you come out of your shell, and I break out what Sultris.com calls the bridge and nearly fall off the bed. We laugh at this, and I feel close to him in a way that I haven't in a long while. Even his laugh is livelier, sweeter. One evening, about a month in, Hank is late coming home after the last tour group leaves. I watch them get into their cars. I watch the cars edge out of their parking spaces. I watch them leave single file onto the exit road. The sun starts to set. I'm just about to call Hank's phone when he walks through the door and goes right to the sink. He fills a glass of water and stares out the window, bringing it to his mouth. Before he takes a sip, he says, "There's something special about those rocks." I snorted this. "What?" Hank shrugs and drinks the rest of his water in 2 huge gulps. "It's like there's something coming out of them, like an energy. I know it sounds silly, but I can feel it." My cell phone is still in my hand. Hank's number still hovers over the screen. I feel like calling it. We learn the new house together. We learn that the oven pilot light goes off a lot, probably the reason the previous tenants dashed all those matchbooks. We learn not to hit our heads on the low-hanging produce holder and shower caddy. We learn that the toilet tends to run, and in a pinch, there's a newer, more comfortable toilet in the otherwise decrepit outhouse attached to the tool shed, which is a 20-second hike from the back door of the house. The path is gravel, but overgrown with grass so stiff it can stab your feet through socks. At the same time, I learn new things about my fiancé, though unlike the house, these are brand new things, not just new to me. He starts waking up at 6 a.m., an hour earlier than his normal time, and without an alarm. He only drinks half a cup of coffee now instead of his normal half a pot. He stops wearing his glasses and switches to his contacts. He does chin-ups on the bathroom bar. He eats huge meals. He eats all the pie I make. I've been making a lot of pies. It's something to do. He is handsome and alert. He sweats from constantly hiking to the monument and speaking to an audience. He comes home smelling of that oniony BO that I loved so much when he used to bike over to my dorm from his house on campus. His voice is clear and strong from projecting loudly to whatever size tour group needs to hear him that day. We have sex almost every night. I fall asleep thinking about how this is the best decision we ever made, coming here, leaving our nerves from too much coffee and our dissertations behind, our dumb, stressed-out day-to-day lives back in the city. But then in the morning, when he rises from the bed in his boxers, I can't help but feel a little lonely. "There's something about those rocks," I remember him saying. I can't remember the last time he pointed out something special, or even superficially nice or pleasing, about me. Our checks come in from the university downstate that funds this place. Even after putting away what we set aside to save for the wedding, there's extra money to play around with. I buy fruit and eggs to make meringue. I buy flour and sugar to make the crusts. I pick up pre-made crusts for when I'm feeling lazy. One Sunday, hauling in groceries from the car, I hear Hank laughing hysterically in the living room. I peek in to see him on the couch watching Laugh-In. Young Goldie Hawn is squealing at an older guy in a tuxedo on the TV screen. Hank looks back at me and says, "Goldie Hawn was adorable." It sounds like Hank is finally getting that stick out of his ass. I'm on the phone with my Aunt Mary, and she's not pulling any punches. This is likely because she's a retired shrink and knows that half the time I call her, it's to solicit her for unpaid advice. Hank is still doing tours, and I'm pacing the length of the trail to the tool shed. I just feel like he must be going crazy. All these things about him are so just the opposite of how he used to be. "He's on vacation," Mary says. "He's relaxing. He's enjoying himself. And these changes, these are things that you've been saying for years you wanted from him." "Yeah, I know, but maybe not all at once. It just seems extreme. It seems like he's crazy." I look over at the path, keeping an eye out for Hank. He's only crazy if he thinks the rocks are, like, actually talking to him and telling him to do things. Is that the case? No. Well, then just enjoy your fiancé and shut up about it. Relax. There's a harsh sound of air whipping around on our phone connection. "Where are you right now? Are you in a wind tunnel?" "I'm retired. Where do you think I am?" There's a pause. "I'm at the beach." I'm standing sideways in front of the perpetually fogged full mirror in the bathroom, investigating the aftermath of several weeks of pie. I suck in the little bump that I, with real commitment, could probably convince strangers as a baby. I remember a time, years before, when Hank and I were lying in bed on a Sunday morning, before the wedding rush arrived and we could play our game. He was nudging my stomach like a cat, and in a rare moment of his desire fully transparent, said, "Your body is haunting." And I had laughed because I wasn't used to him complimenting me, and it made me feel both thrilled and self-conscious. He seemed hurt by my reaction, and I didn't get another compliment about my body for months. It is August. Hank leaves for the rocks early in the morning. He stays behind with the rocks after the last tour leaves. He comes home. He eats whatever dinner I've made across from me. His face is devoid of any of his prior tics or mannerisms. He used to do this thing to push up his glasses, when he still wore glasses, of twitching his cheeks sort of like a rabbit, and the movement of his cheeks would hike the glasses further up his nose, hands free. That twitch doesn't exist anymore. And his hands stay still. They don't tap surfaces, they don't pick their cuticles, they just hang. We don't have sex as often. And when we do, he looks at me, but I feel like he's staring at something beyond my body. Something through the wall, or in another world altogether. After dinner one night, I hear the telephone in the visitor center ringing through the door. It's after hours, so I almost don't answer, but then think, why the hell not? "I'm so glad you picked up. It's Melissa. I'm a big, stupid dumbass. I never got your cell phone number, and I wanted to invite you to this party my sister's having at the rec center. It's soon. Like, it's tonight. It's for somebody at the VFW hall or something with the veterans. But anyway, you should come." Seconds later, I'm actually hopping up and down in our kitchen from excitement. "Our friend wants us to come to a party. We have to go." But the new Hank doesn't need convincing. The new Hank could probably psychically sense that this party was coming. It is exactly what you'd expect from a VFW party. Streamers, flags, an oldies cover band, lots of elderly people, miniature ham sandwiches, bottleneck beers. Melissa introduces me to her sister, who's wearing lots of mascara and a wincing smile that hints at that bitchiness Melissa warned us about. I look over at Hank, who's listening to Kenneth with actual interest. He's nodding and smiling and making soft eye contact. Melissa shoves a solo cup full of mystery punch into my hand and tipsily asks, "Have you seen the aliens yet?" "What aliens?" The music swells over Melissa's voice. A bunch of old men are playing Hit the Road, Jack on their brass instruments. She's shouting about how the locals say the rocks were put there by aliens and how it's a UFO parking spot. I say, "If it's aliens, I feel bad for them because we're boring hosts." And Melissa shouts, "What?" And I say, "If it is aliens." And then my attention is diverted to the dance floor where Hank is dancing with Jenny, Melissa's daughter. He's doing the twist, and then the swim, and then that dance move where you plug your nose and pretend to be going underwater. Jenny's violently windmilling her arms around and kicking her feet. She throws herself at him, and he picks her up by her hands and spins her around. Watching them, I feel a knot tighten in my stomach, and I realize that I'm jealous. I'm jealous of this small child. I'm jealous of her for being fun and easygoing and being able to be held by his attention and by him. When we leave the party, Melissa gives me a long, drunken hug. She smells of a familiar perfume, the kind a girl from high school who was very nice to me used to spray on after gym class. I don't want to let go of her hug, and when I finally do, I feel a little bit like crying. The next morning, Hank wakes up with a bad migraine. Guiltily, I take a little pleasure from this, as it's one clear scrap of the old Hank. He used to get them a couple of times a month, sometimes lasting all day. I bring him some Excedrin migraine and a hot washcloth for his head. I linger in the room as long as I can before I have to go and leave for the tours. I'm clumsy leading the visitors, having neglected brushing up on the information in the past months. In the last group of the day, I spot two girls, about 13 years old, who are on one of last week's tours. They look pissed off and are wearing the same shade of lip gloss. I realize they probably came back to see Hank and are bummed that he's not the one standing in front of them. One of the girls stares off at the trees in abject disappointment, her mouth slightly ajar, the glimmering of her lip gloss rivaled by the glimmering of her braces. When I finish my spiel, I say, "Any questions?" From the corner of my eye, I see one of the girls nudge the other in the ribs, who then giggles and starts to raise her hand. I pretend not to see them and turn the tour group back towards the trail. At home, Hank's migraine persists through dinner. He doesn't feel like eating. But a while after it gets dark, it takes a turn for the better, and he pads out into the kitchen to eat a sandwich. Between bites, he says, "I got an email from Karen." "What did she say?" I pray that she's coming back. Hank pulls up the email on his phone and hands it to me wordlessly. The email is brief. It says, "We'll be staying on in Hamburg. Feel free to stay for fall or contact university for new hires." "Well, so that's it," I say. "We can call the university and they can put out an ad. I want to stay." My stomach falls. I watch him chew his sandwich, but he isn't even looking at me. "But I have school. I have to go back to school." "You can come out on the weekends." The room starts to blur around the edges. "I just feel like I'm doing important work here." He turns to me with mustard on his lip. "Personal work." I'm in the visitor center, rifling through the drawers. I see everything through a hot green lens. My hands are numb and fumble through the papers, the cash box, staple removers. I find what I'm looking for and slam the drawer shut, but not before removing my engagement ring and dropping it into a little jar of paper clips for safekeeping. I don't want it to be an accomplice for what I'm about to do. I yank a flashlight from the supply closet and rush out the door. I'm running up the path, the beam of my flashlight bobbing erratically through the woods, but I know where I'm going. Blood is slamming through my veins so hard I can hear it. It sounds like rapids. I get to the clearing and drop to my knees in front of the biggest stone right at the bottom. I uncap the big red Sharpie that I took from the front desk, and in the shaky glow of the flashlight, I scrawl onto its surface. "Fuck." I crawl to the next rock. "Bitch," I write on it, and then in smaller letters under it, "Shit." And then on the next rock, The Sharpie falters on the O of asshole, and I hold the marker up to the beam of the flashlight. The felt tip is mangled from the bumpy surface of the rock. I throw the marker into the woods and stand there breathing hard. I wipe sweat from my brow with a dirty hand and guide myself onto the path. Walking back to the house, the beam of the flashlight flickers and gets dimmer. My field of vision narrows. I envision Hank sitting at the table, eating a cold quarter of an apple pie, not because he loves it, or even likes it, or even needs the nourishment at this point. It's just something that I've made an excess of, and he's helping it disappear. He eats joylessly, with an unsettled gaze and weak-seeming fingers. I will come in through the front door, and I will tell him what I've done. He will either help me, or he won't. Right after we moved into our first place together, he suddenly asked me one night, right as I was drifting off to sleep, if I believe in ghosts. I snapped to attention. I'd been afraid of ghosts since I was little, thinking the shadows of tree branches outside my window were the gnarled fingers of dead witches, angry at having been burned at the stake. I'd sought the comfort of a nightlight until I was 15, hiding it in my sock drawer when friends came over for sleepovers, and then staying awake for hours with a pounding heart and sweaty palms while they slept. No, I don't believe in ghosts, I said, maybe defensively. Do you? Hank thought for a moment. I think that people see ghosts. People who aren't lying and aren't crazy. I've never seen one, but I know a lot of people whose judgment I trust who say they have. But I do think that whatever they're seeing, it's not real. The brain looks for patterns. It fills in holes. Yeah. I think about the tree branches again, how during the day they were just pretty, dancing tree branches, and then at night, without question, they're dead witches. Hank goes on. Obviously there are people who lie or are trying to get attention by making stuff up. But if somebody I knew and trusted, like you, if you told me tomorrow that you saw a ghost in the bathroom, I'd be inclined to believe you. That you saw something, whatever it was. Just not a ghost, I said, my voice getting heavy with sleep. Right, not a ghost. Because if ghosts were real, that would mean magic literally exists. And I don't believe in magic. Me neither, I had murmured. And then we fell asleep.
Thank you. Oh, let me mic back up. Thank you.
Hi.
If you came in partway through, that was a reading. Does that have a title?
The Monument, I guess, is the working title.
The Monument, yeah. I guess. Ruth Barraby. And you can catch the podcast on Audio Boom. You're listening to Ink and Worm on Radio Free Brooklyn. And I have a quick announcement since this is a good time for a break. So there's going to be a volunteer cleanup in partnership with NYC H2O and Radio Free Brooklyn. You're going to go clean up a beach. So it's happening on September 24th. I'm dyslexic.
September. Is it the 27th or the 24th?
It is the 24th.
Oh, okay.
Not the 27th.
Not the 27th.
Forget
the 24th.
The 24th.
For those who are wondering, is a Saturday.
Okay, let me. Apparently, I can't read. Okay, so PSA for Plum Beach Cleanup. We're going to celebrate National Public Lands Day,
woo!
Which is September 24th, what? With a family friendly volunteer cleanup that fights beach garbage. No garbage on the beach.
No beach garbage. No garbage beach.
This is on Saturday, September 24th at 10 a.m. Join us beach, yeah, at Plum Beach.
That sounds nice.
Plum.
It's a good excuse if you're not done with, like, beach time to go to the beach.
Yeah, and also give back, because how much does the beach give you joy?
Yeah.
So somebody's got to clean it. Protect precious marine habitat in salt marsh. After the cleanup, naturalist Mickey Cohen will lead a hands-on marine ecology adventure.
Ooh.
And volunteers will see Jamaica Bay's creatures up close. How often do you get to do that? Maybe never, unless you show up. To sign up for the Plum Beach Cleanup, visit our website at nych2o.org. That's NYCH2O, like New York City. Water.
Mm-hmm.
Plum Beach is located at exit 8 off of the Belt Parkway.
So. Not that it would say on there, but we should. Is there any way to get there by train?
It does not say on here, but...
You could always Google it, and I would recommend that because that's the best
It's helpful because I feel like I don't know the actual statistics, and that might be something worth Googling as well, but most New Yorkers don't own cars.
Yeah, I think most New Yorkers subway.
Yeah, I think it's smart. I think I was reading this article. This is so tangential to what we were just like listening to. Nothing to do with anything. Here we go. Yeah, I was listening to this thing talking about how cities are actually really environmentally friendly because you push all the people into one space and then you have the systems in place to get them around and they work and then they go out into the forest and natural world that's being undisturbed because everyone's living in cities. And that's what I tell myself sometimes when I feel overwhelmed about living in the city. It doesn't look like there's an easy way to get there by subway, so you'll have to rent a bike or borrow a bike or ride your own bike.
I'm sure that...
Or hitch a ride or Uber. There's still ways to get there.
Yeah, and I'm sure that the website will have more information regarding any of that, or at least I hope so. Just because it would suck if you volunteer and then don't have a way to get there.
Yeah, worst case scenario, it's sort of by Brighton Beach and Sheepheads Bay.
Oh my goodness, I live right around there.
Sheephead Bay, so you could, in theory, like go subway there and then walk. Or
plus there's like such great bike routes around there. So it's totally easy to get to.
Bike NYC, there's city bikes everywhere.
Yeah, this is true.
Yeah, my bike, oh my gosh, I feel like every time I get on my bike... Something breaks on it. First, it was a flat tire. Then I was braking, and my brakes literally, like, broke off of the bike.
Your brakes break?
My brakes broke. And then just this weekend, another flat tire, and I'm like,
Oh, no.
I'm not that, like, vicious of a bike rider. I guess I have an older bike, alas. Okay, back to...
That story was great, by the way. Not meaning to comment on it or anything.
No, yeah, let's talk about it.
Incredibly captivated, and also a little. I guess made me kind of sad, just because the male character reminds me of my boyfriend and my relationship with my boyfriend. And I was just like, oh, I miss him now.
I know. This is like the monument. So. We're talking a little bit about influences, and everyone's been in a relationship where you're just like. There and things are wonderful, and then there's a shift. And I think you spoke so beautifully to this like change in people. And
yeah, well, I feel like it's a pretty common theme, certainly one that I've read about and experienced, where it's that dynamic between a woman and a man, and the woman really wants her partner to be a little bit more outgoing or present.
Something.
Yeah, and friendly or there with her, and he, you know, he just keeps being evasive or aloof, and that's like the source of conflict. So I was curious about exploring what would happen if he did make that change, but not for
her,
or like seemingly the reasons she wanted.
I mean, in a way, it's about control.
Yeah. Like if a change happens. It's still a betrayal on some level, even if it's what you wanted.
Yeah, it's... Well, and this is, I mean, something that's, like, part of the human experience is just, like, having relationships with anyone, even friendships. And then over the course of a year, 2 years, 5 years, people change and you find new passions and you develop new qualities. And sometimes those changes lead you to... You know, distancing yourself from certain people.
Yeah. Getting closer. Can you roll with the punches? Like
it's
after.
Also really, the moment that for me was very touching was when she got jealous of the 7-year-old. Because she felt
it's like irrational jealousy. I mean, let's get personal. That's something that I've like, this doesn't make sense. And yet it's really strongly what I'm feeling.
Yeah.
What the hell?
What? But like the reason behind it, which is she wished that she was. Exciting enough to hold his attention, whereas just like the previous outing that they had gone, she was the exciting one. Yeah. And I think there was a little bit of, at least the way I interpreted it, pride in the fact that she was able to be that and jealousy in the fact that it was switching. Mm-hmm. Or like insecurity for that moment, in the fact it wasn't it was her. Switching. Yeah.
Yeah. And to, I think seeing people in uninhibited sometimes makes you flare up your own guards.
Yeah.
For some reason. So strange being human. what is the
what?
Oh, it's Rumi, I think, of like this being human is, I'd have to look it up. Let me look it up now that I'm
Rumi?
Please talk amongst yourselves.
Oh, but yeah. I don't know if that was intentional or not, but that was just a very...
Like that moment?
Yeah, that was a very humanistic moment that, like, struck me very hard.
Well, that actually happened to me, like, a number of years ago. I was at a party with a boyfriend who I had feeling a sort of strain with over, you know, over the recent months. And he was already pretty charismatic with kids. So it wasn't like he had gone through any particular, like, personality
unusual.
Shift, but... we were at some sort of, like, party at a gallery, and there was a little girl who was just, like, enamored with him and, like, wanted to dance with him. And, like, he was giving her all this attention, and I was just, like, sitting there just fuming. You know, I was so jealous.
Have you ever had the reverse happen? I remember being in a relationship and visiting my partner's family and having one of his, like, younger nieces just, like, latch onto me.
Oh, no, kids don't like me.
And you're like, how am I ever going to have kids? Is that lame person?
Oh, no.
Yeah. Okay, so what I was thinking of is a Rumi poem called The Guest House. This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival, a joy, depression, meanness. So if you're looking for any kind of writing prompt, we've done that before, I believe, but you can use that as a good writing prompt.
Yeah, that one's a great one.
It goes lots of places. I wanted to talk to you, since you seemed, from my perspective, to have some excitement editing. I wanted to talk a little bit about editing process. Having completed only a handful of projects, usually for a class or one reason or another, like it's an external deadline. Mm-hmm. I find that I'm editing up until like the moment I hand it in. And then even then I'm still just like, it's not.
That was the case.
It's
yeah.
It's not. So editing.
Yeah.
It's like the writer's.
Yeah. I mean, most of my writing is pretty, it doesn't have as many parts that I have to link together. It doesn't cover an entire summer. Usually it's more like a character sketch or like a single moment in time. So was the challenge in this one. So I had to just kind of write a lot
and then make it
sit for an hour and stare at the wall and fret about it and then trim some off. And it was fun. It was a new experience, but yeah. High stress. But I loved it. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I stress a lot. It's this dance between the belief that using the right word is using the word that first comes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then this dance between, like, you have to cut out sometimes a half or even two-thirds of what you wrote to have something that's giftable to someone else. Because you almost have to take yourself out of the writing so that you can hand something to someone and it's like half of something and they bring the other half through their own experiences. So it has to be able to resonate. That was a lot of halves. And anyways, yeah, so that's like the thing of like, I think that was like part of the beatnik movement of just like train of thought, flow of words, like the word that comes first is the word that's true to you or whatever. Mm-hmm. Versus this editing to create something more polished and succinct. I mean, you mentioned before the show you're not actually very good at free writes.
No,
which is
funny.
I don't know how you can not be good at just like writing or even just writing. I don't know what to write.
I think it's more just like I psych myself out about it. I just end up writing about food or something really simple.
Food is it's wonderful. Hard, yeah. To write
it's a great
about.
Thing to write about.
I wonder how many books have things about food.
I mean, certainly cookbooks.
So, are there things that you do to get yourself jazzed up or like ready to write?
I mean, I used to have a very, actually, we talked about this the last time I was on the podcast, like lighting a special kind of incense and mm-hmm. having a special area and or like wearing a special item of clothing.
Do you have special clothes?
I'll wear I'll rotate a couple of sweaters that make me feel very
cozy.
One
of my friends, this is just like adding and interrupting, she wears a mask and listens to drums sometimes while she walks.
That's commitment.
While she writes. That's amazing. Yeah. I know. I was like, what? Where's my writing mask?
But I've had to kind of abandon a lot of my routines because I'm in the process of moving and I'm subletting in a room that I'm not that familiar with. And there's a cat. So I've just been sort of improvising.
Has
with
that
getting
transitions?
Into the routine. Yeah, transitions. And like, so I'll write for a little bit and then pet the cat. Yeah. And then come back to
have
it
you
later.
Found that been, have you found that that has been helpful or disruptive? Like, if you have a set routine to then be forced to break out of it.
I think a little of both.
Yeah, I think it's good to not have routine, but I always am like, I need my things.
You gotta get a little crazy sometimes, switch things up.
Yeah, guys,
gotta sublet your place sometimes. Yeah. And
it's something I was thinking about of like just this morning when I was writing. I was like, I need to go on a retreat. I just need to like be disconnected. I need to be away from everything. And I need to be like, here is, you know, 5 days or 2 weeks. And I just get, my job is to be there. Mm-hmm. I was like, but to like apply to these residencies, you have to have a body of work, and I don't have that. And I was like blockading myself and damning myself. And it's just like, I think there's value in that, though. I know a lot of writers that get the majority of their work done by getting out of their life and then coming back to it, especially if you have like families, I imagine.
Yeah.
It's like the only way to do it. But yeah. Who knows? It's like this weird thing for me that I always have to change my approach because I start doing something, it works really well, and then it stops working. So I have to start doing something else, and then that works really well, and then it stops working.
I just like to find something that works without fail first.
If that thing
exists.
See
if that gets a little worn down after a while.
Oh. We'll see. How has a cat influenced your writing?
He's very distracting, which is good. I mean, with a story like this where I might get a little too
into it
or just like a little too, and then they did this and then they went here and then they did this, and it just like doesn't really flow very well. It kind of reminds me to pause. So he takes my attention for a while and I don't quite go down that spiral.
Oh, something just happened on the iPad. There's this blog, Authors with Their Cats. It's just like a thing. People collect pictures of authors with their cats.
I think I've seen that, yeah.
Yes. Well, we actually are getting close to the end of our show, believe it or not.
But
and something happened with the iPad that's tripping me out. But we like to end our shows, as you know, with rapid-fire series of questions. So we talked a little bit about routines. Mm-hmm. I can't remember what other questions we asked you last time, but I'm going to throw the ball at NASA.
Ooh.
And say, NASA.
Well, thank you.
Will you ask the first question?
I will ask the first question. Is there a book that you haven't gotten to that you mean to, like reading-wise?
Last time I said Infinite Jest. But I think the question was, what book have you not read that you'll never read?
Oh,
and that's still true?
Yeah, that's still true for me. Nasa, have you read Infinite Jest?
I have not, no. Yeah, but that's not because I'm avoiding it so much as I haven't heard of it.
Oh, I think I'm actively avoiding it at this point because people are like, maybe. Oh, it's so great. You have to. And I'm like, no.
I just love my Aslan.
Nope, I don't.
I guess now it would be The Handmaiden's Tale.
Ooh. Oh, I like that one. That's one that I've read.
It is a classic.
Or just like Margaret Atwood in general. I don't think I've ever read anything.
And I think we've had conversations about this where I swoon just at the mention of her name and you're like, I don't get it.
I don't know.
And I'm like, how can you not get it?
I have such a weird connection with The Handmaiden's Tale because I read that like not too young, but like too young, like at 11 or 12. And so I don't, my images of it, and especially because I read it with The Scarlet Letter, are really intertwined with a lot of like weird like feminist imagery. I need to reread that book.
I think that's appropriate. But I am a big fan of rereading, though.
Yeah.
Revisit the books you read in school. Like, I feel like everyone has a couple books in middle school, high school that they were like, oh, I remember liking that. Go back and read it now, because it's always interesting to see how you've changed and yada, yada, yada.
And also your understanding of English just might be better.
Oh my gosh, you're like, I don't have to study for 10 hours to understand what this means.
Well, it's just a lot of imagery I think was screwed up in my head.
Or just combined with really like hypersexual feminism. Discussions, who knows? Okay, my question is a little bit lighthearted. Favorite podcast or Netflix addictions?
I haven't been listening to a lot of podcasts, so Netflix. I mean, I always watch 30 Rock. It's just sort of my go-to thing.
It's a classic.
But I think it was either on Hulu or Netflix, but I like go through periods of watching Cheers.
I love Cheers. Yeah. We talked about that last week too.
Yeah. Just like I like 80s stuff. I like the way it's filmed. It makes me feel really safe.
It actually
very comforting.
Does. I'm a big TV person, and I can actually speak to why it makes you feel a little bit safe, but I feel like that might take up a lot of time. But it was a lot of the television sitcom filming of those days specifically was for that feeling, which is not as true nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
Just gonna say that.
Thanks, Nisa. We'll rediscover that perhaps in a future episode.
Sorry, I was just really excited. I'm like, yeah, it does, because it's supposed to.
They did that on purpose. Question for you specifically, have you watched Fuller House?
Yes, all of it.
Have you?
I have not. Have you?
I have not. It was like this thing where I'm like, I don't
There's something know. About... DJ and Steve reconnecting, that's just like, it just stabs me in the heart. Like, and in the first episode, and like, I started watching it, of course, thinking like, oh, this is gonna be silly and I'll make fun of it, because like,
and yet there's this part of you that's like so happy.
And then Jesse starts singing Forever to Becky, and I just like lost it. Aww. You just waterworks.
These were, I mean, I think about this, I'm like, these were real people in the shaping of my childhood.
Yeah.
Like, they were people I came home from school and I was like, how are they doing?
It just sideswiped me. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, definitely Fuller House.
Nice. Oh, golly, it's my turn. If I was to enter your house, what book would be on your coffee table?
I'm subletting, so I don't have any books with me.
No books?
They're all in a suitcase.
Not even one?
Oh, my goodness.
I didn't bring any books. No,
no, that's an amazing answer.
That's kind of, I mean, my suitcase. There, you'd probably find like one of a few books that I've been reading. I've been reading about J.D. Salinger, about the women in his life. He had a daughter, and he had a girlfriend who was like 18 when he was in his 50s. And it's like an autobiography by her. Her name is Joyce Maynard. And it's about how he's just kind of a monster and was really manipulative and controlling. So I'm like reading about how he was just like a bad influence on women in his life.
It's so strange. I was just reading the Zen and the... In the Art of Writing by Ray Bradbury, and he talks about being compared to Salinger, and like people are like, why can't you write things like that? Because science fiction was so new and people were like averse to it at that point in time still. And then like to hear you say, be like, he was a terrible person.
He was a crazy guy. Like,
jeez. Have you ever, this is a random question for everyone, have you ever like committed to a period of not reading? Because I know... this is coming from the artist's way, and this is the first time that I actively avoided reading something, because it's like, for 1 week, just don't read anything new.
Books-wise, or like anything?
Like as much as you can avoid it.
Probably, I don't think intentionally, but I've probably just like gone through just dry spells and just like didn't pick up a book for a while.
Yeah. I've never gone through a period of not reading a period, but what I have done, and I think I finally kind of broken myself out of it, was I went through a period where I was like, I don't want to read books, I can only read plays. Because I was trying to find new material or just expand my basic knowledge of plays. Yeah.
So I always thought, like, well, why read this when I could actually read a script? So I went through, like, a year where I only read scripts.
That makes sense.
But now I'm reading books again.
Yay, I love books. I love the library. I mean, geez, library is like my saving grace as a child and still today. I'm just like, oh, I'm so grateful for libraries.
I always feel so weird because I only go to the children's section and I'm like, I should grow out of this. Nope. But they're the best books.
Nope. Or YA. YA is pretty hot. Yeah. So,
and I always look, it always looks the best. It's like decorated so nicely.
Oh, yeah. It's so whimsical and magical, and you can be like, okay, life is okay. This leads into our last question, probably looking at time. Where do you find the books that you read? Thoughts?
I find a lot of them, and we talked about this last time,
walking up and down the streets of Park Slope.
Yeah, they're everywhere. People feel bad throwing them out, justifiably, and so I pick them up. But I buy them, too. I go to the library sometimes. Yeah. I'm bad about returning them on time, so...
So bad.
That's why I do ebooks. They just disappear. No fees.
I haven't got into that, but
yeah. I mean,
there's time.
I don't judge people. Nasa, how do you find your books?
Very much the same way. Either meandering around, hearing about a book that I have interest in, or going to the library and then like grabbing something. Also, if I watch television and they refer to something that sounds interesting or it's based on something, I will find it that way.
I feel like for me personally, a lot of my books lately have come from Brain Pickings. Have you guys heard of that with Maria Popova? She has this webpage, Brain Pickings, where she does like an astronomical amount of articles, just like exploring concepts of new books. So I feel like I read an article about a book and then I want to read it based on her little review of it. So that's where my reading list is, my overwhelming, never-ending to read list is coming from. Well, thank you so much again for coming and sharing your story. I'll send you links. And again, if you missed part of it, you can catch the podcast. I'll upload that hopefully Tuesday or Wednesday. And oh, I have a word. I was like, I'm missing something. What am I missing?
Take this or leave it, people.
Take it or leave it, if I can find it. I want to make sure I'm looking at the spelling before I try saying it. I'll leave you with the word, take it or leave it. Syzygy.
Syzygy.
Awkward silence. There we go.
Alone, spend the afternoon making a speech. Speech made you nervous that you couldn't eat. You came